This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The real Koberger. Some of you out there think you know a different version of Brian Koberger than the one that Brian Koberger has already presented to the world in court, in his actions, in his writing, in the evidence, in pretty much everything. So we are going to do a little examination of some of these thoughts, these impressions that he is someone other than who admitted and then obviously found guilty after admitting to the crimes in Moscow, Idaho. We're going to break down essentially the conspiracy theories. And I know there's a lot of them out there. We're going to try and hit on some of the bigger topics here in this three-part series that we're going to be dropping for you today. So if you have thoughts, I welcome them in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. All I ask is that you back up what you're saying with actual evidence, not feelings, okay? Feelings are one thing, evidence is another. And it needs to actually be based on real evidence, too. It can't be, I heard from a person of a person, you know, uncle's cousin, that's, you know, that's not anything. That's just noise. So whether you agree, disagree, I will respect you. But I do ask, whatever your opinions are, lay it out. Lay it out in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. There's a leather knife sheath, lying in a dead girl's bed. The snap on it is still fastened. And on that snap sits the DNA of one man. Not a smear, not a flake, not the kind of trace you squint at and argue over. There's a lot of it. The lab that did the genetic work on this case said it out loud, and they had pulled, I think this is important here, hundreds of times more DNA than they get in an ordinary case. So it's not up for debate. There was a lot of DNA on the knife sheath. Unless you're going to believe that somehow someone in the lab is in on framing Brian Koberger, which doesn't make any sense. A lot of people, they start getting involved to go down that road to frame a college weirdo in this who has a track record of not getting along with human beings. Anyway, I don't want to go down the rabbit holes too much here. Hundreds of times more DNA than they get in an ordinary case. Their own word for the amount was catastrophic for the man who left it. The sheath is the whole case. Nearly every theory you've heard about Brian Koberger being framed, set up, or quietly railroaded by a small town that needed somebody to blame runs straight through it, and it stops dead. People have spent years building careful stories about planted evidence and a sloppy, rushed investigation. Every one of those stories depends on a single move. They need you to believe the one piece of physical evidence that matters doesn't mean what it plainly means. We're talking, of course, the Koberger conspiracy theories, and we're taking them all apart, like I said, in this series. I welcome you to please give us your thoughts. Press subscribe in the comments section and your thoughts there. The links are in the description. The forensics, the night itself, and the people, those theories destroy this piece here. This part one in our three-part series starts where all the theories start, with the DNA. If you're just catching up, four students were stabbed to death at an off-campus house in Moscow, Idaho, in November of 22. Kaylee Gonzalez, Madison Mogan, Xander Kernodal, Ethan Chapin. For 6 weeks after that night, nobody was arrested. 6 weeks is a long time. It's long enough for an entire internet to solve the case in its own head before police said a single word in public. That silence is where the theories were born, not because the evidence was weak, because there wasn't any evidence in public yet, and people can't stand an empty space. I mean, just look at the Nancy Guthrie case. They fill it in when there's nothing there. Usually they fill it in with a story more thrilling than the truth. The truth is less thrilling than a cover-up. The kind of DNA that we are talking about, touch DNA, is just skin cells. You shed them all day long. When you grip something, when you handle it, when you pull a knife from a sheath, your thumb drags across the snap. You leave cells behind. A single source male profile on that snap isn't a mystery. It's a fingerprint made of skin, left by the man who handled it. Boom. Plain and simple. This is where the framing theory takes its first hard hit. The people who swear the DNA was planted need that DNA to be tiny. They need a suspicious little speck. Some agent could have smudged onto a snap in the lab. Well, it was the opposite of tiny. There was so much genetic material that the lab built a full profile and ran it through investigative genetic genealogy, comparing it to public ancestry databases, and climbing the family tree it pointed to. That tree led to a multi-generational family in Pennsylvania with a particular thread of Italian ancestry. It led fast to one man. You don't accidentally leave a robust single-source sample behind. And you can't fake a family tree. Some of the framing crowd has a fallback. They say the genealogy moved too fast to be real. And you can't identify a stranger from DNA in a couple of weeks. So the FBI must have known his name some other way and worked backwards. With a weak sample, sure. That work can crawl for months. And there are cases where it's not a great sample. And it takes longer. That actually, as far as what we understand, might be what's happening with the Nancy Guthrie case right now. With a mountain of clean DNA pointing at a family that only crosses Italian ancestry twice, it can move fast, and the fallback ignores the most important part. The genealogy was never the proof. It was the lead, a name. Investigators drove to Pennsylvania, pulled the trash outside his parents' house, and got DNA that tied back to the sheath. After they arrested him, they swabbed his cheek. The genealogy pointed the finger. The trash and his own cheek confirmed it. There's a darker version of that complaint, and it's the one the believers seem to love most. They say police hid the genealogy from the judge, that they built a false trail and misled the court to get their warrants. The defense actually made that argument in those words and called it a deliberate deception. The judge who heard it wasn't impressed. It went nowhere. And the reason it went nowhere is simple. The genealogy was a tip, the kind of lead police get when they verify independently. Which is exactly what they did when they pulled the trash and swabbed his cheek. A fight over how they first got his name doesn't change whose skin is on the snap. Now, follow the genealogy to where it went, because this is the part the framing theory never touches. Once they had a name, they got a warrant for his online shopping. And there, voila, it was. Months before the murders, Brian Koberger bought a knife on Amazon. Not just any knife, a K-bar knife. The exact style of blade that sheath was built for. With the sheath and the sharpener in one order, in his own account, with his DNA on the snap. Put the framing theory next to that one receipt. For Koberger to be innocent, somebody had to plant a robust DNA sample at a murder scene. And that same somebody had to already know this random PhD student had bought the matching weapon online so the frame could stick. That's not a conspiracy. That's a fantasy that needs far more luck than the truth actually does. His own lawyers had an answer for the Amazon buy. They said the whole family shared that account, so who's to say it was him? The prosecutor said flatly it was his purchase. And look at what that excuse is really doing. It isn't defending the knife was bought. It's hoping you won't notice that a man whose DNA was on the sheath also happens to be the man whose account ordered the sheath. That's not a coincidence you wave off by pointing at his relatives. Maybe it was dad. Maybe it was one of his sisters. Who doesn't need a K-bar knife that accidentally gets used in a murder months later with his DNA on the sheath? Just a happy, weird coincidence. Woohoo! How does this wacky world work? There's a cuter version of the staging theory aimed at the sheath itself. It notes the sheath as a Marine-issued K-bar and argues the killer dropped it on purpose to send police chasing some imaginary man with military training. Clever. It also dissolves the second you remember whose skin is on the snap and who bought the thing. You don't stage a frame by leaving your own DNA on the prop and putting the purchase on your own card. So that's the evidence pointing at him. The sharper objection is about the evidence that supposedly points away. And this is where people who think he's innocent push the hardest. There was other DNA at the house. That's true. And I'm not going to wave it off. Blood from an unidentified man turned up on a handrail inside the home. The court file calls him unknown male B. A separate sample showed up on a glove found outside the house. Unknown male D. And yes, those are blood, not stray skin cells, which is the version the defense leans on the hardest. Blood on a stairway in a house where a stabbing happened sounds like the killer. But blood in a shared rental college party house can be days or weeks old. Somebody cuts a hand, nicks a finger, gets a bloody nose, and it dries on a railing nobody bothered to scrub. Unidentified isn't the same as involved. And a glove on the ground outside a house in the middle of winter in Idaho, in a college town, isn't a co-conspirator. It's a glove. Well, that's weird that there's a glove on the ground. And you know who says that the most? People who've never lived in a winter environment like Idaho. Those of us who've grown up in environments just like that know that if you go for a walk in a college town in winter, you probably could get like somewhat of a glove collection going by the end of your walk if you really wanted to. People drop them all the time. It's not anything. And now look, test away, look at it. I'm not saying don't look, or maybe they should have looked more. Maybe they were going. I don't know. But the mere existence of a glove randomly outside the house near the roadway, it's not like it's like it wasn't on the it wasn't on the porch. It was in an area where people could have walked and it could have fallen. That happens all the time. This is not anything. It's like the Nancy Guthrie thing at the beginning, too. Oh, my gosh, there's rubber gloves everywhere. Like, and you all were wearing rubber gloves when you were searching, and it turns out you all dropped them. Or the one that they thought, well, maybe this is one. Turns out it's from the guy who works at the restaurant down the road. Flicked it off. His own word. Winter gloves on the ground in winter in a college town where a lot of kids are walking around drinking in the middle of the night from house to house. Again, not quite the same as having your DNA on a knife sheath under a murder victim. And your Amazon history shows you bought the fucking knife. There's that. Oh, and then you tried to buy another one right after to make it look like you didn't lose it. The strongest card the believers have is the one I haven't mentioned yet. And they're right to leave with it. Under one victim's fingernails, the lab found a low-level mix of DNA from more than one person, and none of it matched Koberger. On its face, that's the killer's skin cells under her nails, and it isn't him, except it isn't how that evidence works. We all carry other people's DNA under our nails pretty much all of the time. I know it's kind of gross to think about, but just Google it. You're like, no, I don't. I clean my face. Trust me. The odds of you having someone else's DNA, a complete stranger's DNA, someone you've never really met or know, underneath your fingernails at any given time, your odds are much higher to have that there than they are to not. If you function in society, if you go around, you go to the store, you go to this, you go do that, you use your hands for anything, really, that other people have touched, you got a buffet of other people's cells under your nails. Ooh, that's kind of creepy to think about, isn't it? But it's true. That's why the argument in so many cases of there's other people's DNA under their fingernail. Yeah, there always is. picked up from doorknobs, shared towels, a friend's hug, a couch, low-level mixtures. There was no high-level mixture here. High-level mixtures, scratch, boom. Low-level mixtures, that's life. And they're notoriously messy and hard to pin on anyone. And none of it matching Koberger does not mean it matched the real killer. It matched nobody. It's the same category as the handrail and the glove, unattributed background in a house full of people, and it doesn't outweigh one man's profile sitting on the snap of the murder weapon. The same logic answers what a lot of people call the biggest piece, a hair said to be found in Ethan Chapin's hand, longer than Koberger's. Logged as debris and never tested. I want to be careful here. A lot of up-close grisly crime scenes detail floating around this case never came from this court file. It came from a television special. And the lead investigators went on the record and called that special specifics gross inaccuracies and complete falsehoods. They knocked the claims down one at a time. So when somebody says they saw a detail that proves a second attacker, the first question is where that detail actually came from. Even take the hair at face value. Untested material at a crime scene isn't a buried smoking gun. It usually goes untested for the dull reason that it isn't probative. A stray fiber, a loose hair, debris in a house full of people never analyzed gets repeated like it means deliberately hidden. Most of the time, it just means a strand of something that was never going to tell you anything. In a home where dozens of people came and went, the muddy water argument leaves one thing out every single time. A judge already looked at all of it. The defense stood up and said the unknown blood destroyed the case. The judge's answer was about as blunt as a judge gets. A defense's DNA or a defendant's DNA on the sheath of the murder weapon in the victim's bed, that, he said, is probable cause every day and twice on Sunday. The defense attorney actually asked the courtroom out loud what a knife sheath at the scene even means. The judge answered her, "If you're killed with a knife," he said, "that probably means a lot." Those unknown samples were never hidden either. They were disclosed. They were argued in open court. These weren't secrets that were hidden away somewhere. They were weighed by the same judge who saw the full picture and wasn't moved, because a few ambiguous traces in a party house don't outweigh a man's own skin on the actual weapon that he bought online. Ignored is the wrong word. Outweighed is the right one. The rushed, sloppy part deserves a bit of an answer too, because it gets said constantly. This wasn't a case that hung on one cop's hunch. The sheath DNA was developed by an outside lab, run through genealogy, narrowed to a family, confirmed against trash pulled 2,500 miles away, and confirmed again with a swab from Koberger himself. That's not a corner that was cut. That's the same piece of evidence checked three different ways, each one landing on the same man. Sloppy investigations don't survive that kind of cross-checking. They fall apart. This one did the opposite. And there's a last objection that sounds sophisticated and is really just kind of flattery. He studied criminology. The argument goes, so he'd never have been clumsy enough to leave his DNA behind. Studying crime isn't the same as committing one without a trace. Plenty of people who study a thing are terrible at doing it. A film critic can't direct. A sports writer can't play. A student of murder isn't a master of getting away with one. He did leave the sheath. He did carry his own phone. He did drive his own car past the house. The theory that he was too smart to get caught runs into the simplest fact of all. He got caught. Same goes for the footprint nobody found. A person who moves through the house fast, who may have shed an outer layer or worn coverings, doesn't necessarily leave a clean, castable shoe print on the way out. No footprint isn't a clue pointing at a second intruder. It's just the absence of one more piece of evidence in a case that already has more than enough. The missing DNA and the extra DNA have one thing in common. They do the same job for the same people. The extra DNA lets you believe there's another man out there. The missing DNA lets you believe the case against the one man is flimsy. Both let you dodge the simplest explanation there is. A man a knife he ordered, at his own cells on the snap of the sheath he left behind, and a young woman's bed under her body. The physical evidence in that house isn't flimsy. It's the part of the case the theories can never get around, which is exactly why they pour so much energy into trying. So they change the subject. If you can't beat the evidence inside the house, you go after the clock. You argue no single person could have done what was done in there in the time he had. That's the next move. And it comes apart just as fast. We're going to go into that in our next segment. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss it. It's coming up in just a bit. Substack and YouTube is where you can weigh in with your thoughts. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The cruelest thing the internet did in this whole case landed on a man who had nothing to do with the murders. He dated Kaylee Gonsalves for years. By every account, he thought he was going to marry her. He called her the love of his life. And in the hours before she was murdered, she called him more than once. The internet took those phone calls and turned them into a confession. They weren't a confession. He was cleared. But cleared never travels as far as the accusation. He's the clearest example of what those theories actually cost, so it's worth slowing down on him. His name got dragged for years. His aunt said half of America believed her nephew did it. He set up a little social media account for the dog that survived that house. And his real crime, the thing that put a target on him, was that a grieving young woman reached out to her ex in the last hours of her life. This is where the theories change shape. It's part three in our series looking at the Koberger conspiracy theories. You know, the real Koberger. Oh, it's over here. The real Koberger. I should note, it's an actual screen. I'm still pointing at the wrong area. It's like, oh, I have a monitor over there. And so I get confused. Tony gets his directions mixed up. We've covered so many so far. So if you haven't checked it all out yet, please go back and look at it. Just a few back here on the YouTube feed or podcast feed, wherever you're watching us. And do hit subscribe. This is where the theories change shape, when the physical evidence won't bend and the digital trail won't bend. The stories stop being about evidence and start being about people. People are softer targets. And that's where this case gets ugly. I encourage your thoughts in the comment section, wherever you're watching this. Substack and YouTube are two probably the best for you. We started this series with the DNA that they swear was planted, then the night they insist one man couldn't have survived. Now we're at the people, the ex-boyfriend, the internet convicted, the survivors they turned into suspects, the confession they say was coerced, and the motive that doesn't exist, which might be the hardest part of all. Here's what those phone calls actually were. Kaylee had broken up with her boyfriend only weeks before, right before a plan to move to Texas for a job. And by her own family's account, she was second-guessing it. They said she worried she might never find another guy like him. They said she was looking for every excuse for him to pick up the phone. That's what the calls were, a young woman reaching backwards towards something safe on the edge of a big change. The long call, the repeated calls, all of it. Police, they looked at him hard early because of those calls, and they cleared him. But they did look. They looked hard, and that's good. Her only family stood beside him and said he had nothing to do with it because he didn't. Reaching for somebody you love isn't evidence that they killed you. It's just heartbreaking in a way that has nothing to do with the crime. The other thing the doubters can't get past is the wait. The murders happened around 4 in the morning. The 911 call didn't go out until almost noon, roughly 8 hours. On its face, that gap looks impossible to explain. there's an explanation, and it isn't a cover-up. One of the surviving roommates heard noises that night. She read them as ordinary, figured it was a roommate up playing with a dog or people still keyed up after a night out. She opened her door. She heard crying, and she saw a figure in black and a mask that covered the nose and the mouth walk past her towards the back sliding door. The affidavit described her standing in what it calls a frozen shock phase. She locked herself in her room. Later, she made her way downstairs to the other roommate. That phrase, frozen in shock, isn't an excuse. It's a documented thing's brain do under sudden terror. The friends who got called to that house the next morning have explained the whole sequence out loud. Two young women, 19 and 20 years old, in a college town that hadn't seen a murder in years, couldn't make what they'd half seen line up with reality. One of them thought she might have dreamed it. They didn't want a cover-up. They froze. Then they couldn't believe it. And then they called for help. And they'd been out drinking the night, and it was 4 a.m. Add that to the mix. And cognitive abilities. And the believers have a sharp comeback here, so I'll take it head on. The phone records show those two roommates weren't just sitting in the dark. That morning, before the 911 call, one of them was on Instagram and Snapchat. The other called her dad. They were active for a while. If they were so traumatized, the argument goes, how are they scrolling their phones? But that's a misread of what terror does. Freeze and disassociation don't always look like a person curled up in a corner. Sometimes they look exactly like a numb kid scrolling a phone, not processing that the friends upstairs might be gone. But without actually seeing them, they don't know. Just a weird guy going through the house, telling herself the thing in the hallway was a bad dream. People want trauma to look like the movies. It rarely does. What it looked like that morning was two young women who genuinely did not understand yet that they'd survived a massacre. If you want to know what that night did to one of them, she said it herself later in open court. She talked about being barely 19 when it happened, about sleeping in her mother's bed because she was so afraid to close her eyes, about panic attacks that hit her away like a wave and stopped her breathing. That's not a person who knows more than she's saying. That's a survivor carrying the weight of a locked door and a masked figure in a hall for the rest of her life. Treating her like a suspect isn't just wrong. It's cruelty layered on top of trauma. And then there's a detail those survivors gave that the defense fought hard to keep away from a jury. One of them described the masked man she saw that night as having bushy eyebrows. It's a small human-specific thing, the kind of feature you notice on a face in a doorway. Koberger's lawyers worked to get that account excluded. You don't fight that hard to bury a witness who helps your client. You fight hard when the witness is a problem and he has bushy eyebrows. There's an uglier version of suspicion aimed at one of those survivors built on her private writing. People got hold of a young woman's personal journaling, her words about loneliness, about wanting to belong, about the ordinary insecurities a lot of people carry. And then they tried to spin it into proof she was unstable or involved. Again, that's not detective work. That's cruelty with a theory attached. The inner life isn't a clue. A diary about feeling lonely isn't evidence that you helped murder your friends. It's evidence that you were a young person with feelings like everyone else in that house. And there's a darker spin on the survivors that deserves to be named and buried. Some people have decided the two roommates lived because they were part of it. That you don't walk out of a house where four people are killed unless you were on the right side of the knife. The investigators have a planer read. They believe he didn't expect to find anyone awake, that running into people upstairs wasn't the plan, and that he got scared and left before he finished what he had come to do. One of those survivors came face to face with him in the dark wearing a mask. Surviving a killer who's rattled and running isn't a confession. It's luck. And it's the kind of luck that leaves a person broken for life. And there's the broadest theory of it all. The real killer is still out there, and police slapped on blinders and ignored everyone else. Here's the problem with that. The defense actually tried to run that play in court. Koberger's own attorneys asked a judge for permission to stand in front of a jury and point at four other named people. The judge read what they had and ruled it entirely irrelevant. Nothing, he said, linked those individuals to the killings. To suggest otherwise would take nothing short of rank speculation. A judge already walked down those roads with the defense's best material in hand and found them empty, which leaves the hardest question the believers have. The one they save for last. If he did it, then why? Where's the motive? I get in this. We don't have a clean motive. We may never have one. He's never explained himself, but no motive isn't the same as no evidence. And it's the opposite of wrong man. Strangers do get murdered by people fixated on them, and there were signs of exactly that before this night. We've gone down the roads of Koberger's psychology a lot, and I think once you understand that, it makes sense. In the weeks before the murders, Kaylee told her roommate she'd seen a man standing at the house, a shadow outside, and she thought someone was following her. A woman who lived nearby told police she'd seen a nervous man in her yard and was nearly certain it was Koberger. A stranger with no connection to you doesn't get safer because there's no connection. Sometimes a stranger fixated on a house is the most dangerous thing there is, precisely because nobody sees a reason to be afraid of him. This was a man who chose to study killers for a living, who wrote a paper on processing crime scenes, who searched the internet for Ted Bundy. He'd studied under an expert on one of the most infamous serial killers in American history. The missing piece isn't a hole in the proof. It's the absence of the story, or of a story, that would let us sleep. And we want that story so badly that some people will trade away a mountain of evidence just to keep looking for it. And then there's the plea. And they claim he only confessed because they scared him with the death penalty. Here the believers have a real point worth respecting. Innocent people do sometimes plead guilty. It happens, usually when the evidence against them is thin or when a coerced confession is the only thing the state has got. But that's the opposite of this. This wasn't a thin case propped up by a confession. The confession came on top of the DNA, the phone, the car, the purchase, the scanner, the selfie. And he didn't take the kind of plea where you say, I still maintain I'm innocent, but I'll take the deal. It wasn't an Alford plea. Under oath, the judge asked if he was thinking clearly. He said yes. Asked if anyone had promised him anything. He said no. Asked if he was pleading guilty because he's guilty. He said yes. Asked by name if he killed Kaylee Gonzalez, Madison Mogan, Zana Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin. Four times he said yes. He admitted he walked into that house to commit murder. And by the time he said all that, his only lawyers had already tried everything. They tried to strike the death penalty over an autism diagnosis. They tried to throw out the DNA. They tried to point at other suspects. They tried to delay the trial. A judge denied all of it, a guilty plea made under oath to avoid a firing squad sitting on top of evidence like this. Isn't a man being railroaded. It's a man who'd run out of moves and knew it. And if you still think the plea was some injustice done to Koberger, look at who is angriest about it. The family that fought the deal hardest was Kaylee's. They were furious, not because they thought police had the wrong man, but because the deal let the right man keep his life. They wanted the death penalty. They wanted answers he refused to give. No one of the closest in this case on any side walked out of that courtroom believing an innocent man had just confessed. The argument that he was railroaded lives almost entirely among people who were never in the room. The gap is real. We'll probably never know why. But a gap in a story isn't a gap in the proof. That confusion between the questions we still have and the case that was actually proven is the exact place every one of these theories lives. An unanswered question is an empty space, and conspiracy rushes into empty spaces like water. Look at how many of those spaces have already been filled with nonsense and then drained. People swore Koberger had been messaging the victims on Instagram from fake accounts, debunked. Investigators I've ruled many things out. There's a whole theory about a mysterious Greek connection, debunked. A bartender people were sure had served him said he'd never set foot in the place. The man people were certain was him at a memorial service turned out to be someone else. People decided he'd graded his students more generously after the murders, proof of some guilty conscience. And then it came out that his professor had already sat him down over how harshly he graded. One after another, theories went up, and one after another, they came down. That's the pattern, not a thread anyone's pulling, a series of empty spaces filled with stories, emptied again by facts. And while all of that churns, four young people are still gone. Kaylee, Madison, Zanna, and Ethan. Their families don't get a mystery to chew on. They got a sliding glass door, a man who studied crime walking through it, and a silence at his sentencing where an explanation should have been. We've gone through all of it now in this series. The DNA, the night, the people, every theory had its moment and every one came apart. The hardest thing to accept about this case is also the simplest. Sometimes the truth isn't complicated. It's just brutal. And needing it to be more than it is sometimes isn't what we get. Needing it to be more than that is a comfort the four of them cannot afford to give us. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love for you to weigh in. Wraps up the three-parter here in our series. And I should say, if you are watching this right now, as a new release, I will be back from my honeymoon. This is a series I recorded prior to for some fresh content while I was out. But we're back live again. I know Robin has been there. I'll be back on the show again tomorrow on Hidden Killers Live. I will see you there. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.